Good morning.
Dear Lord, I hope this makes sense. Some things that seem a little more crystal clear at wee hours of the morning look a little muddled when you see them in the light of day. It's like, oh boy, okay. Anyway, I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I would encourage any of you to do the same as these weeks and months move on. It's always a very humbling experience to wrestle with the text, and I enjoy it. It's a little different than what I typically do from day to day, but it's meaningful, and hope you'll take a chance to get up here too. Anyway, we have a nice church. It looks good. It's simple. It's clean. It's practical. I look around here and I see, I think of all the people who had a hand in this. You know, I think of our former pastor Tim, who did all this woodwork. I think of Ravon, who made this banner. I think of Holly, who did this mural. I think of Don out there putting all those walking paths in, and Jeff's son working on all the landscaping work Ken did on the landscaping, planting flowers, and Jordan planting trees, and all the work Carla's helped formulate a plan for all this. I think of the committee we had to put the playground together. I remember Chris Faust's vision for having this commercial kitchen that we could feed the masses with. You know, all the fabric panels from around the world out in our fellowship area. That's all. I think one more thing, Joel, my brother-in-law Joel, did the tile in the bathrooms. There's a lot of hands in this, and for a group this size, we have a pretty incredible facility, really. So what if one Sunday, while we're sitting here, comfortable, enjoying the sanctuary and the worship that many people have worked to build and prepare, Jesus shows up at the door, and he doesn't look happy. Instead of open hands and outstretched arms, his hand is clenched around a bullwhip. Uh-oh. And then he proceeds to tear things up. I wonder what would be our first reaction. On one hand, we might be left asking, maybe somewhat indignantly, "What are you doing? We built this all for you." On the other, I imagine there might be some relief in being freed from the responsibility of holding this all together. If Jesus himself tore the place down, we could all walk away guilt-free. And as I've learned working in the automotive industry, and this probably holds true in many situations, happiness is having someone else to blame. However, I've walked with this group long enough to believe that once the initial shock and awe faded, I think we could get past those initial gut reactions and ask some serious questions about why this is what Jesus felt our church needed today. Why did Jesus get so upset about the state of the temple? After all, this is a guy who had shown nothing but love and compassion for those on the wrong side of the law and the wrong end of the social spectrum. He had been nothing but cool, whether he's facing demons, petulant officials, even a killer storm. And if rage is okay for the Son of God, Son of Man, why doesn't he get upset about other things? Like, say, the Roman occupation? Isn't this guy from the house of David? Remember the glory days when Israel was a force to be reckoned with? Isn't that worth getting a little fired up about? Or better yet, what about his betrayal? He had 12 hand-picked men, and one of them went bad. Man, it's hard to find good help. What about Peter's denial? Maybe Jesus didn't realize that a guy nicknamed The Rock might not respond to subtlety. What's going on here? Now, an admirer of Jesus, as an admirer, we could just gloss over this incident in the temple. Maybe pretend it didn't happen. Maybe write it off as Jesus having a bad hair day. Kind of like what we do with our dear leader when he sends out an angry early morning tweet. But as followers of Jesus, we need to dig for some understanding about what is going on that deserves such a passionate response. I want to start with the Old Testament scripture. I'm not going to go into quite as much detail with that one, but I want to touch on it. God hands down the Ten Commandments to Moses on Mount Sinai. At face value, these rules are unconditional. No ifs, ands, or buts. They're Ten Commandments, not Ten Suggestions. But as you read through the Old Testament, you can see that although these laws are the essence of the covenant between Yahweh and Israel, they are not treated as what Kant might have called universal maxims. The original of the intent of these laws was to establish practical means of preserving and building community within this chosen tribe of Hebrew people. Now, I give you a little chart, give you a little handout that I'm not going to read through that whole thing, but it's just a little table I pulled from one of the resources I got from my father, sort of explaining what the context, what the intent of each one of these laws was to be. But to summarize that, with this initial context in mind, you can start to see why thou shalt not kill does not necessarily apply to the Amalekites, the Ammonites, the Canaanites, the Edomites, the Egyptians, the Moabites, the Assyrians, the Philistines, the Midianites, or any other host of Israel or Judah's enemies. Don't get me wrong. Just because these rules were originally intended for one people doesn't mean that other people could not reap the benefits of following this code. They're good rules, and they're a big part of the cultural binding that kept the Hebrew people alive and cohesive through centuries of exile, slavery, oppression, and even genocide. Good behavior never guarantees good outcomes, but it would be foolish to think that following this code doesn't dramatically improve your chances of leading a happy and healthy life. Furthermore, a community that upholds these principles will have a much better chance of not only surviving but thriving. That being said, I want to focus on the idea that these laws were and are intended for the benefit of the people, not to suppress them. Hold on to that thought a bit, because now I'm going to shift gears a little bit and look at the gospel message. Fast forward to Jesus' day. Now, I am a big fan of the rock opera Jesus Christ Superstar by Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice. And the film version from 1973 does a really good job of portraying the ominous presence of the Roman occupation throughout the Holy Week narrative. And one of my favorite scenes in this movie comes just before the cleansing of the temple in the gospel message for today. And this scene is where Jesus is confronted by Simon the Zealot. Now, amid a fantastic dance break, Simon pleads with Jesus to add a touch of hate for Rome to his teachings. Now, the scripture doesn't tell us a whole lot about Simon. However, we do know the Zealots made up a political group whose first priority was above any religious or social agenda was the liberty of Israel from any foreign rule. Now, in this scene, Simon promises Jesus that he will rise to a higher power and win back a home for the Jewish people, if only he would choose to lead the people against Rome. Now, although this scene is a bit of fabrication on the writer's part, Simon's manic performance kind of reminds me of the devil tempting Jesus with power over all the nations. I bring this up because I think it's important to realize that Jesus was very well positioned to lead a successful uprising against Rome. And as followers, it may be just as important to acknowledge what he chose not to do. So here he is, riding into town, just as the city population is starting to swell with other pilgrims gathering for the Passover festival. Think of this festival as sort of a Independence Day celebration, except for people who are no longer independent. Remember, these are a proud people with God on their side who could rightfully claim a place on a very short list of groups who successfully pulled off a peasant revolt. In fact, the next time you want to fritter away a little time on the computer, check out Wikipedia's list of peasant revolts to see just how bad the odds are of actually winning liberation during such an uprising. These are also a people who had been promised a Messiah by several prophets. In their mind, they were due for some salvation. It should also be noted, Rome's military was spread pretty thin throughout the empire. Hence the reason Caesar would put up busts of himself throughout the occupied territories, help maintain the illusion that Caesar's got his eyes on you. So overall, it would have been a great day to kick some Roman butt. But Jesus refuses to get worked up about politics, as if to say to Simon, why bother with a revolution? Do you think you can do any better ruling Israel? Hate to tell you, Simon, but Israel's record for producing good kings is not that great. From the time of Solomon around 931 BC until the Assyrians took over the north in 723 BC when the Babylonians took over the south, Israel had 20 kings and Judah had 20 kings. Only 8 out of those 40 kings, 20%, 1 out of 5, were considered good kings. And the only criteria we're using to put them on the good list is that they were faithful to God. So, even the guys on the good list did plenty of bad things. What if Jesus did choose to lead an uprising at this point? What would be the cost? And the lasting benefits? Jesus is obviously focused on a very different kind of revolution, or perhaps a revelation. Although John places the account of the temple cleansing early in Jesus' ministry, and the Synoptic Gospels place the event in the middle of Holy Week, both accounts keep this backdrop of Passover in focus. Also understand that the temple in Jerusalem is a big business. Let me see, is it still up there? Okay, good. And that the three pilgrimage festivals throughout the year are the busy season for this big business, Passover being the biggest of the three of those festivals. At this time, depending on which historian or archaeologist you want to believe, the population of Jerusalem is probably around 100,000 people. For these pilgrimage festivals, the population could easily double. Like Jesus and the 12, pilgrims typically would arrive about a week early to visit and go through purification rites to be ready for the sacrifice of the Paschal Lamb. Additional troops would also be brought in from the coast to reinforce their crowd control. So there's a lot of people crammed into a relatively small city. And Rome, being a little short on troops, like I said, is always a little jittery about keeping the peace. Now, King Herod was in charge at the time, and he was a builder, with the temple and his palace being some of the biggest architectural triumphs of the day. However, motivations are important. And we should note the differences between Herod's agenda for this second temple, that's what we're seeing here, and compared to the purpose of the original temple built by Solomon. Now, despite Solomon's tendencies to accumulate excessive numbers of wives and horses, Solomon was squarely on the good king list and built the temple as an expression of his faith in Yahweh. Herod, although he was raised a Jew, was much more interested in his own power and legacy than he was glorifying God. I don't think it's difficult to argue that Herod built to glorify Herod. Furthermore, the temple was sort of a concessionary bargain between Rome and Israel. They got to keep their culture and religion as long as they kept the peace and paid their taxes. However, motives aside, Herod's temple was pretty amazing. Even the temples were in awe of its grandeur. And as we read in Mark chapter 13, verse 1. And as Jesus came out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings." Now, I was hoping to show you, I had this little nerd moment where I found this 3D virtual tour of Herod's temple that the Mormons put together. And it was really cool. And like if you put it on your iPad, you can actually hold the iPad up and go like this and see you moving around. But it didn't work out to show that this morning. So we have a very 2D representation of the temple up on the screen. But still, I want to take a minute to sort of point out some landmarks in here. Now, it's a little difficult to see, but on this back corner is what was called the Antonia Fortress. And that is where typically if the Roman leaders were visiting. Pilate was probably staying there. You would actually have, can't really see it here, but this was basically the corner of the temple, and there would be towers up there where Roman soldiers would be continually stationed, kind of looking out over the goings-on of the temple. So it's not like the Romans are down the street even. They are right there. They are right there on the corner, on the wall of the temple grounds. Looking kind of that way towards the north, Calvary would have been down and up the side of the valley. So you could see Calvary from the temple. You really can't see this. There's a little portico here that would have been what they called the royal portico, that would have been where Jesus did most of his teaching. Now, there is, although you really can't see this very well, there's a little lattice wall, kind of right down through here. And there's the same thing on the other side. That outer portion was called the Court of the Gentiles. That would have been where the money changers and the vendors of the sacrificial animals would have been allowed to set up shop. Now, just to get a sense of what an undertaking these festivals would be for the temple staff, consider one lamb might feed about 10 people, okay? So if you have 100 to maybe 200,000 people participating in the festival, somebody has to slaughter tens of thousands of lambs all on the cusp of the festival, because unfortunately Herod was unable to complete the walk-in freezers before the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. So we got a lot of food to prepare, a lot of sacrificial rites to perform. The pilgrims coming to the festival needed to bring a sacrificial offering. If you were making the pilgrimage, it was not a great idea to bring your own animal. Something might happen to the animal along the journey. Or even if you arrived with what looked like a perfectly good animal, the priest might deem it flawed in one way or another and force you to buy one of the animals from the temple-sanctioned vendors out in the court. This is kind of like how they don't let you take a cooler into the baseball game, because then you won't spend your money at the concession stand. So most people left their animals at home or sold them at home and just brought the cash. Which brings me to the money changers. The temple only takes one currency, the Tyrian shekel, which ironically features an image of the Greek god Heracles. Apparently, this was the only readily available coin that didn't feature an earthly ruler. I'm not sure why images of foreign gods were more palatable than ones recognizing foreign leaders, but this shekel was the only currency accepted for the mandatory temple tax or other voluntary or sin offerings. And since there are at least 7 different coins commonly circulated in Israel at this time, odds are you were going to need to exchange some money when you got to the temple and pay a nasty surcharge on that transaction. And of course, the temple gets a cut of both the animal sales and the currency exchange. Now, one note, I was hoping to show you this a little up close. Where do your offerings go? Well, right in the middle. Now, the tall part, see if this laser will work. The tall part's the holy of holies and the sanctuary part. Out here in this part, that's called the Court of Women. And out around the perimeter of the Court of Women was a sort of colonnade where they had the collection boxes. That's where the treasury was. And one thing I found interesting when I was doing this research is the collection boxes were like a big, maybe a wood box like this with this brass funnel that in the top. And so when you go to pay your temple tax or one of the voluntary offerings, you drop your coins down this funnel. And how did Jesus know that the poor woman only gave two coins? Well, they made noise when you dropped your coins down these little, what they called trumpets. And you could tell exactly how much somebody was giving by the noise it made. And if you remember in Matthew chapter 6, Jesus said, "So whenever you give alms, do not sound a trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues." That's what he's talking about. He's talking about these trumpet-shaped boxes that make a lot of noise when the wealthy hypocrites empty their purses into the funnels, sounding the trumpets with their conspicuous giving. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Overall, this place kind of reminds me of Disneyland. It's supposed to be like heaven, you know, where everything's clean, everybody has a fun time, except it's really expensive to get in. It's expensive to eat, the souvenirs are expensive, and if you don't have connections, like my aunt who lived in Anaheim and was able to get free tickets for our family, you either bring a boatload of money or you don't get to play. Now, of course, the temple does have bills to pay. Priests have to eat too, but it was almost like they were offering a religious experience for sale, selling at a price that would have kept a lot of financially struggling people out of the show. Now, I know I talked about this a little while ago, but do you remember the intent of the Ten Commandments? Practical ways to build and preserve the community? That was the goal of the law. But here, the keepers of the law are taking advantage of the people. The largesse of the temple had become more important than raising up and preserving the community. The business of the temple had become a distraction from its mission, a detraction from its sanctity, and overall a burden on the people. So meanwhile, the people here are expecting a Messiah with zeal against Rome. And instead, Jesus goes in a very different direction. John quotes Psalm 69:9, "I am eaten up with zeal for your house." Jesus shows that what he really came to do was some major house cleaning. And what better time to do it than a spring festival? Jesus walks in and makes no attempt at negotiation. He doesn't sit the temple leaders down and gently ask, "Now can't we make some better choices?" No, he cracks the whip, forcibly removes the corrupt elements. The fascinating and jarring thing is the contrast between how he deals with the corruption in the church versus the individual sinners he encounters throughout his ministry. Prostitutes, tax collectors, adulterers all get treated with patience and compassion, but not so much the church. I don't want to let individuals off the hook here, especially during Lent. I mean, this is a time for spiritual house cleaning. And if a swifter and a little end dust isn't up to the job, maybe you should consider bringing in someone who's handy with a bullwhip. Perhaps a flamethrower. Maybe a wrecking ball. But things are different when Jesus is faced with corporate deterioration. Something happens when you form an organization, whether it's a marriage, a church, or a company. That organization takes on a life and spirit of its own. On some level, it's a collective of the individuals, but it also takes on its own inertia and culture. And if that culture becomes malignant, maybe negotiation is not an effective treatment. Chemo, radiation, surgical removal are all relatively drastic, violent solutions to malignancy, but maybe that's what it takes. I'm curious that whether or not as a church we're ready for that kind of treatment. Am I ready for that? I don't know. However, comforting or not, I guess when somebody shows up at the door with a bullwhip, maybe it doesn't matter if you're ready or not. Maybe what matters is whether you are admiring the spectacle from a distance, maybe thinking, "My, that Jesus, he's quite dramatic." Or have you committed to follow, even if it means the uncomfortable task of cleaning house, letting go or tearing down? As one who makes a living building and fixing things, that's a particularly difficult pill to swallow. I definitely prefer the attitude of onward, ever upward, forward, never backward. But I need to be ready to follow Jesus, even when he's walking directly away from my comfort zone or setting fire to the things that I hold sacred, or worse, knocking down the things that I worked long and hard to build up.